Good afternoon, everyone. Happy New Year, day early. And we don't say Happy Hanukkah here, but today is Hanukkah, and we're going to be talking about that subject. Apologize for the late start. I've been having a lot of technical difficulties. Anytime I want to go live from my office for some reason, we never have any problems in the auditorium for the church services, but for live streams, a lot of issues. I think part of it is my computer is getting really old. And might need to start thinking about getting a new one. But I am glad you joined me today, and I hope that you learned some things today about Hanukkah. If you have any questions, I will do my best to follow the live chat and try to answer those for you. But the holiday of Hanukkah is becoming more and more popular amongst Christian people and even Baptist people, and it reveals an extremely high level of biblical ignorance for a Christian to think it is any way appropriate to celebrate Hanukkah. And I'm going to explain why that is. I've been posting against this idea. I've been receiving some criticism, and I fully intend to address these things, and hopefully, you all will learn something from this, that I am not just being mean. I do not hate Jewish people or anything like that. That's kind of the new modern libtard thing. Anytime you are against something, if you call out some kind of sin, you get accused of being hateful. Why do you hate so much? And but I do hate error, and me trying to expose error, trying to correct people. I don't think that's hatred. I think that's probably love. And so I'm going to explain why this is a big deal to me. But before we get into that, I want to give people a chance to get on and get live. I know I sent everybody to the wrong link. That one is now history. It was not working. But do want to just mention a few things too. As far as the channel, you'll notice now we have memberships. Now, I want to make sure everybody understands how this works, because I put out something showing that more than half of my views, half my viewing time comes from non-subscribers. Okay, subscribe. Subscribing's free. Okay, that is not about the money. That is about get people getting subscribed so they will see everything. And I would encourage everybody to subscribe. Plus, it makes me look like I got more pull if I've got a lot of subscribers. So, of course, hit the subscribe button for crying out loud. More than half of you that watch this video are not subscribed. What are you doing? Are you just haters lurking around waiting for me to say something you can call me out for? All right, just go ahead and hit subscribe. Put your subscriptions on private so you won't get exposed. So the people who don't want you watching me will know that you're watching this program. But another thing too, I've been paying attention to some things in my analytics. I think one of the reasons a lot of my views are from non-subscribers is my top two states by far for views, watch time, the whole nine yards are California and Texas, and they are very close to each other. And the next state after that is a distant third. Those two are very close to each other. And I think I know why those people don't want everybody knowing that they're watching me, because they probably get kicked out of their churches. Because they go to churches like that. So just hit the subscribe button. Okay, just go ahead and do that. Now, as far as the memberships go, okay. Now, again, I've got a weirdo segment of people that watch my stuff, and they're very suspicious, always on high reprobate, false prophet alert, and things like that. So they assume the worst about everything, and they've been very offended by hiding content behind a paywall and things like that. Let me just explain what's going on with the memberships. Okay, obviously, I'm trying to unlock certain features of YouTube, learn more. I got our account approved where they can do the live chats or not the live chats, the super chats and all that kind of thing in case people want to donate, in case they want to be supportive of the channel. Nobody has to, but if they do, I have added a perk. To where, as soon as I upload a podcast, they are able to watch it. I am not taking anything away that you had before. I have always scheduled my videos to premiere at a certain time. And so I have not taken, so all of you who are subscribed and were watching before I had memberships, you are not going to lose a single thing. People who join as members, not subscribers, people who join as members, they will receive an additional perk of being able to immediately watch something. Because if you're really excited about that particular one and you don't want to wait the 2 or 3 days, because you try to work the algorithms a little bit. You try to release things at certain times when you think they'll be likely to get viewed more, you know, trying to play all that game. But for those who are members, you can just watch it as soon as I upload it. So the only thing I've changed is now I'm uploading some podcasts that I've recorded a little sooner than I would have before, just because I want to make sure that there's as much benefit as there possibly can be to those who have signed up as members. So if you want to do that, there's a link in the description. You don't have to do that. It's not going to change anything one way or the other. Those that think it's just about the money and stuff like that, trust me, you don't get enough of it that's a motivation. It's definitely not enough to corrupt me. So either way, stop being sensitive. Nothing will change for you. If you just want to remain a regular subscriber or a regular secret viewer, you are not losing anything by the fact that I have added memberships. Those who join will just gain something that they didn't have before. So anyway, that's enough about that. But let's go ahead and talk about this subject of Hanukkah, because I have my reasons for why I think this is becoming a bigger thing. And I'm definitely going to share my opinion when it comes to that. But I also want to make sure I give the facts as well when it comes to Hanukkah, because again, people are very sensitive. And of course, me being vocal and speaking truth on this has upset people. I'm going to read a comment to you on Facebook. I did a couple posts on Facebook against Hanukkah. And here's one of the quotes that I got. It says, "Tommy, Hanukkah, spelled with C-H." And one thing too, people do too, they reveal themselves to just kind of show they're trying to throw the Jews a bone and they're obsessed with all things Hebrew, is they like to spell things in the most weird Hebrewish sounding way possible, or say things. People with American accents like mine, people with a Southern accent, all of a sudden they're like flimming everything whenever they're talking about Jewish stuff. It's just like we've just mysticized Jewish people to this crazy extreme. If we only got obsessed about the King of the Jews like we are about the other Jews, we would be doing really good in Christianity. But this guy, Tommy, Hanukkah is strictly a Jewish celebration of an event in their history. It is not foolishness. It is not for Gentiles or non-Jews. It is also nothing for you to be upset over. Life's too short to let something petty and upset over. Like the song says, don't worry, be happy. Let it fly. You'll only drive yourself insane if you let everything that goes by you upset you. Just be happy." Now, right there is an example of somebody who often, when they read your post, they will read their personality and their insanity into something. Now, why would he assume that because I am just pointing out stupidity that I am unhappy? Sometimes when I am pointing out stupidity and I'm doing posts like that, I am being somewhat provocative, trying to get dumb people to think and trying to wake people up. And I actually enjoy it greatly. In fact, when people lose their minds over it, especially weirdos, I find it very amusing. I do like to troll a little bit and things like that. I'm all for that kind of thing. I did the same thing too on Twitter. I said, "If you claim Jesus celebrated, talking about Hanukkah, you're showing a total ignorance. Wishing Jews a happy Hanukkah when they have no temple would be like wishing a woman happy anniversary after her husband divorces her. They can make up whatever goofy reason they want to celebrate." I just totally lost it. But anyway, notice what Peter J. Crotafilo, he is somebody that I interviewed one time, is a real nut job, claims that he's Jewish. I got no reason to Take that away from him. I have every reason to say that he has nothing to brag about, but he said, again, Jesus celebrated Hanukkah, get over it. Pastor Matt first, he had shared that screenshot, but then also he said, John 10:22 would disagree with you. I'll take the Bible over your opinion. Now, Peter is a parrot. He obviously has not studied this out. He has no idea what the Bible says about this subject. He is repeating things online. And a couple years ago, I started noticing people point out John 10:22 and using that to claim that Jesus celebrated Hanukkah. That is absolutely ridiculous. And not only does it show people, not only do they not know what Hanukkah is, do they not understand what it celebrates, but it mainly shows they do not understand the purpose of the temple. They don't get it. There are so many areas in theology where they are clearly lacking that if they just had a basic elementary understanding of the Bible, they would realize what a foolish thing it is to celebrate something like this, how backwards it is, how it sends a wrong message, how it's inconsistent even with Old Testament customs and practices that they had. And I'm going to show you all this as we go through this. This is an important subject. And so if you look up Hanukkah from Wikipedia, it'll say Hanukkah is a Jewish festival commemorating an early victory in the Maccabean revolt against the Seleucid Empire, the recapture of Jerusalem in the year 164 BCE, and subsequent rededication of the Second Temple. It is also known as the Festival of Lights. And so, listen, I don't have a problem with any group of people. I don't have a problem with Mexicans celebrating Cinco de Mayo. I don't have a problem with Americans celebrating July 4th. I celebrate that because I'm an American. And I don't even have a problem with the Jewish people celebrating the victory against the Seleucid Empire during the Maccabean Revolt. All cultures celebrate different military victories and things like that. That's normal, okay? That is normal, but that is not all that this is. It is much more than that. In fact, too, even Christian people, you say, are you calling people's salvation into question? I'm just like the Apostle Paul when he talked about those who are observing days and months and years. He said, I'm afraid of you, lest I bestow labor upon you in vain. I wonder about you people that celebrate this stuff because you're revealing an ignorance. You're revealing an ignorance that is so deep that I question and I wonder how one can come to that conclusion with the Holy Spirit inside them reading a Bible. I don't know how you can do that. And so I'm not saying you're not saved. I'm just saying I'm not going to go around defending your salvation. But this is more than that, because when they are lighting the menorah, okay, if you celebrate Hanukkah, you do the famous lighting of the menorah. Here's a picture that I used. This is a Hanukkah. This is a menorah. And notice how it has the branch in the center, but then it has the eight branches off to the side. And what they will do is they will light one of those for each day. And then by the end, they are all lit. And so Hanukkah is observed for 8 nights and days, starting on the 25th day of Kislev, according to the Hebrew calendar, which may occur at any time from late November to late December in the Gregorian calendar. The festival is observed by lighting the candles of a candelabrum with 9 branches called a menorah or Hanukkah. One branch is typically placed above or below the others, and its candle is used to light the other 8 candles. This unique candle is called the shamash. Each night, one additional candle is lit by the shamash until all 8 candles are lit together on the final night of the festival. Other Hanukkah festivities include playing the game of dreidel and eating oil-based foods such as latkes and whatever this word is, I'm not even going to try to pronounce, and dairy foods. Since the 1970s, the worldwide Chabad Hasidic movement has initiated public menorah lightings in open public places in many countries. Although a relatively minor holiday in strictly religious terms, Hanukkah has attained major cultural significance in North America and elsewhere, especially among the secular Jews, due to its occurring around the same time as Christmas and coming to be treated as a Jewish counterpart or alternative to Christmas. So, yes, Jews will recognize this isn't really one of their biggest holidays. However, in places like America, where Christmas is a really big deal, any place where Christmas is a big deal, the Jews find it necessary to make a bigger deal about Hanukkah in order to keep their people away from the customs and the practices of all those celebrating the birth of Christ. Because obviously, this is meant to be a distraction away from the true light that came into the world, Jesus Christ. And so that is why it has kind of been elevated. And sadly, many Zionist Christians, they are giving honor, they're giving recognition, they're giving respect to this holiday, not understanding this is actually commemorating a miracle. It's not just commemorating the Maccabean revolt, okay? No, the lighting of a Hanukkah, that is commemorating a miracle that never happened, okay? In fact, I guess it could have happened, but here's the question. What is the source for this miracle? Where do people claim it came from? Now, what they will often tell you is if you want to learn about Hanukkah, you can read about it in the Apocrypha, because people understand there's a certain level of respect even amongst a lot of Christians from the Apocrypha. Sometimes people will tell you, the King James, they had the Apocrypha in there. So you can read about Hanukkah in the original 1611 King James. It's like, well, okay, let's do that. And let's see if there's this famous story that's in there of a miracle where they only had enough oil to light the lamp for one day, but it miraculously lasted 8 days. That story, my friends, is not in Maccabees. You know where it is? It's in the Babylonian Talmud. Now, they don't like to bring that up. They don't like to point out the fact that that is the origin of that story, because they understand Christians have a problem. Real Christians, guys like Peter, he thinks there's some goofy stuff in the Talmud, but no, there is some very wicked, blasphemous, satanic stuff in the Talmud. And that is where that story comes from. That is where that miracle comes from. And this custom of lighting the menorah, that is a Babylonian Talmudic thing. It is not in the scriptures. It is not even in the Apocrypha. It's in the Talmud that came hundreds of years after the time of Christ. Came 600 or 700 years after, or five or 600 years after the time of the Maccabees. So they're referencing these things. And I have done deep research into this. I have read their sources, and they are purposefully misleading. Even when they're giving you the facts, they'll mention things to get you to let your guard down, to try to get you to connect it to the Bible. And they'll even talk about John 10:22, which, by the way, we are going to get to that, to show that just folks never legitimize Hanukkah based on what we see in John chapter 10. That is absolutely wrong. So let's go ahead and read what Maccabees actually says, because this is important. Because what we're going to see in Maccabees, okay, I think is legit. I think it makes sense. I think it's, I consider Maccabees a good historical source for information. And so I do not doubt the events that are spoken of in Maccabees. In fact, they're actually very, very consistent with the prophecies of Daniel. So I think there's a ton of legitimacy to this. And so let's go ahead and read this story of where we find a reference to the rededication of the temple, because that's what Jesus was in Jerusalem for, the Feast of Dedication. We would not know what the feast, you cannot know what the Feast of Dedication is just from reading your Bible, by the way. It is only referenced one time in John chapter 10. The reason we know what the Feast of Dedication was is because of Maccabees. Okay. And again, all of you who think you get your beliefs just from the Bible, if you talk about the Feast of Dedication and you tie it to, Hanukkah and that time of year and stuff like that, you went outside the Bible. Okay. And I'm going outside the Bible. I'm going to the Apocrypha. I'm going to the same place the Jews would go. And anybody, I think this is a good source of history. So let's go ahead and read what it says in 1 Maccabees. This is in chapter 4, and we are going to start reading in verse 36. It says, "Then said Judas and his brethren, behold, our enemies are discomfited. Let us go to cleanse and dedicate the sanctuary." Now, just a little bit of background. We're not going to read through all of Maccabees, but remember, Antiochus Epiphanes, he came through and took over Jerusalem, and he went and desecrated the temple. He slew a pig on the altar, and all kinds of abominations were committed in the temple. This is the second temple. This is the one that was built after the Babylonian Empire. This temple got desecrated. This is the same temple that was standing when Jesus came in his triumphal entry and did not offer a sacrifice within that temple. No, he declared the temple desolate that day on that triumphal entry. He said, "Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. It was not fit for an acceptable offering of God." And Jesus made the offering of God that was prophesied of in the scriptures, and he made that sacrifice outside the camp, outside the temple, on Mount Calvary. We as Christians, we have walked away from the things of the temple, and we have followed Christ without the camp, bearing his reproach, the reproach brought on us by the Jews, and we have turned our back on the things of the temple, as did God, and that is why it was destroyed in 70 AD. That was judgment. Another subject, but let's go ahead and keep reading a little bit more of this. So the Jews have gotten the temple back, but they can't just immediately put it to use. There needs to be a period of cleansing that takes place according to the law. And so it says, "And all the hosts assembled themselves together and went up into Mount Zion. And when they saw the sanctuary desolate and the altar profaned and the gates burned up and the shrubs growing in the courts as in a forest or in one of the mountains, yea, and the priest's chambers pulled down, they rent their clothes and made great lamentation and cast ashes upon their heads and fell down flat to the ground upon their faces and blew an alarm with the trumpets and cried toward heaven. Then Judas appointed certain men to fight against those that were in the fortress until he had cleansed the sanctuary. So he chose priests of blameless conversation, such as had pleasure in the law, who cleansed the sanctuary and bare out the defiled stones into an unclean place. And when they consulted what to do with the altar of burnt offerings, which was profaned, they thought it best to pull it down, lest it should be a reproach to them because the heathen had defiled it. Wherefore they pulled it down and laid the stones in the mountains and in the temple in a convenient place until there should come a prophet to show what should be done with them. Then they took whole stones according to the law and built a new altar according to the former and made up the sanctuary and the things that were within the temple and hallowed the courts. They made also new holy vessels, and into the temple they brought the candlestick and the altar of burnt offerings of incense and the table. And upon the altar they burned incense, and the lamps that were upon the candlestick they lighted that they might give light into the temple." Now right here would have been a really good place for them to tell us about that miracle about the oil lasting for several days. That is nowhere in it. We see the candlestick referred to, we see them lighting it, but we have no reference to this miracle. That nobody knew that miracle happened until hundreds of years later, and when they wrote about it in the Babylonian Talmud. But let's keep reading. "Furthermore, they set the loaves upon the table and spread out the veils and finished all the work which they had begun to make. Now on the 25th day of the 9th month, which is called the month Kislew, in the 148th year, they rose up betimes in the morning and offered sacrifice according to the law upon the new altar of burnt offerings that they had made. Look at what time and what day the heathen had profaned it. Even in that was it dedicated with songs and citherns and harps and cymbals. Then all the people fell upon their faces, worshiping and praising the God of heaven who had given them good success. And they kept the dedication of the altar 8 days and offered burnt offerings with gladness and sacrificed the sacrifice of deliverance and praise." And so notice there the reference to the dedication of the altar 8 days. That's where that comes from. "They decked also the forefront of the temple with crowns of gold and with shields, and the gates and the chambers they renewed and hanged doors upon them. Thus was there a very great gladness among the people, for that the reproach of the heathen was put away. Moreover, Judas and his brethren with the whole congregation of Israel ordained that the days of the dedication of the altar should be kept in their season from year to year by the space of 8 days from the 25th day of the month Kislew with mirth and gladness. At that time also they builded up the Mount Zion with high walls and strong towers round about, lest the Gentiles should come and tread it down as they had done before. And they set their garrison to keep it and fortified Bethshura to preserve it, that the people might have a defense against Idumea." So Notice right there, that is where the Feast of Dedication comes from. The Feast of Dedication was a real thing. It is referenced in John chapter 10. We're going to see that. It did last 8 days. So there is some basis for this event. That is a fact. And I fully acknowledge that. But understand that when you understand what they were celebrating, why they were celebrating, then it causes you to scratch your head a little bit when you see them continuing to celebrate it today. Because wait a minute, they lost the temple was not destroyed, but they lost access to it. And when they got it back and they were able to use it again, obviously that was a day to be celebrated. They were still under the old covenant and needed the temple at that time. So of course it was appropriate for them to celebrate this during that time. And there was nothing wrong with them having a period of celebration for 8 days and making it a yearly thing. Absolutely nothing wrong with that. Here's my question though. If they celebrated the fact that they got the temple back, why are the Jews celebrating today when they have no temple? They built up these walls around the temple so the Gentiles wouldn't be able to come in again and destroy it. But guess what happened? In 70 AD, a couple hundred years later, it happened again. The temple was destroyed. So what are they celebrating? Then they were celebrating the fact that, hey, you know, our temple's been restored. Our fellowship with God can be restored. We can have our practices and our cleansings. All these things can be restored. And so let's just assume, okay, obviously this is insanity, but let's just assume the Jews are right, that the Messiah did not come, that we are still under the old covenant. Why are they celebrating a restored temple when that temple has been destroyed? That doesn't make any sense. And why are they lighting a menorah, celebrating the fact that the menorah remained lit for 8 days when the menorah is currently out? Think about that. That makes no sense. In fact, you know, where is the menorah today? You want to know what happened to the menorah? Well, in 70 AD, it was stolen. It was taken away when Titus came through and destroyed Jerusalem. Right here, this is known as the Arch of Titus that was built back then in the first century, that they made to greet him and his armies as they came back home to Rome. And look what we see carved on that Arch of Titus. Notice we have the menorah right there. That was one of the things that they carried out. And that goes all the way back to first century. So you guys, let the light go out again. Right here today, this is a replica of that same menorah. A replica, not the same menorah, but this is from a picture I took when I was in Jerusalem. And look, it's not lit. So again, I could see why they were celebrating the lighting of the lamp when the lamp was finally lit again. Why are they celebrating the lighting of the lamp when the lamp is out? Okay, that doesn't make any sense at all. So there's so many reasons it is absolutely inappropriate for the Jews to have a celebration like this. And it's especially inappropriate for Christians to celebrate this type of thing, because it absolutely makes no sense. Jesus is the light of the world. Jesus's body was the new covenant. The old covenant was the temple and the things of the temple. Those were taken away and the new and better covenant was brought in. We celebrate that. We celebrate Jesus Christ, the light of the world. And so lighting a menorah like that and doing it too as a way to honor the Jewish people is one of the most backwards things I have ever heard of. And here's another thing. And so there's another thing too about this whole Hanukkah thing. So here's, notice this too. Does anybody notice a big difference between this particular menorah and this particular menorah? And I am not referring to the Star of Remphan that they have in the middle on this one, but there is a really big difference between this one. Notice how many branches. So you have the center one, but then you have 8 branches coming out of it. What do we have in this one? We have 6 branches coming out of it. There, we have zero evidence anywhere of any type of menorah in the Bible with 8 branches. In fact, in Exodus 25, 31, it says, thou shalt make the candlestick. Candlestick is the word the King James uses. Of pure gold, of beaten work, shall the candlestick be made. His shaft and his branches, his bowls and his knops and his flowers shall be of the same. And six branches shall come out of the sides of it. Three branches on the candlestick on the one side, three branches on the candlestick on the other side. So notice this particular menorah that the Jews all are putting out is a perversion of the real one. And they're wanting to do it because they want to do the thing of lighting eight candles. And I don't even have that big of a problem with them having a different kind of menorah. God's done with those things anyway. But I'm just showing you this to show that this tradition that you all are practicing is foreign to the Bible, to the Old Testament, and it for sure is foreign to the New Testament. It was foreign to Judaism until hundreds of years after the time of Christ. Also, too, another reason it's ridiculous, and as Christians, we overlook these things. We miss these things because we've never been under the Old Covenant. We've never had a temple. But the menorah was always supposed to burn, or the candlestick. Exodus 27:20, it says, thou shalt command the children of Israel, and they shall bring thee pure oil olive, beaten for the light, to cause the lamp to burn always in the tabernacle of the congregation without the veil, which is before the testimony. Aaron and his son shall order it from evening to morning before the Lord. It shall be a statute forever unto their generations on behalf of the children of Israel. So you have the Holy of Holies, and outside the Holy of Holies, you had what was known as the Holy Place, which is where the candlestick stood, and it was always supposed to be lit. Hey, Israel, is your menorah lit today? Oh, wait, you don't have one. Oh, yeah, you've got the one, the fake one, sitting behind glass in Jerusalem, but you have no temple. Hey, you lost your protection. God had the temple destroyed. And understand, if you're right that the Messiah never came, you are in trouble with God if that menorah is not lit and if that temple is not standing. 1 Samuel 3:2 says, and it came to pass at that time when Eli was laid down in his place and his eyes began to wax dim that he could not see, and ere the lamp of God went out in the temple of the Lord where the ark of God was. And Samuel lay down to sleep, that the Lord called Samuel. And he answered, here am I. And if you go, and y'all are familiar with that story, but what does God, as soon as that lamp goes out, what happens? God calls Samuel, prophesies to him about Eli, how he is going to be destroying him and his house, and how God is going to take the priesthood from him. Why? He failed in his office as the high priest. His sons were involved in all kinds of wickedness. And it was during the days of Solomon that his line was removed. And Solomon put in a new priest, Zadok the priest, who was also of Aaron, but was a different line than Eli. He lost the priesthood, just like Israel lost the kingdom and it was given to another nation. Why? Because they failed to be a light to the world. When Jesus came at his triumphal entry, they had no fruit. The fruit tree was barren, and he cursed that fig tree and it withered up. And it died, and he lent out his vineyard to other husbandmen. We've got countless parables talking about all these things. And so the letting that lamp go out is a big deal. Israel, why are you celebrating the lighting of a menorah when the menorah is out? It makes no sense. You should be having a time of mourning. In fact, if they were consistent with the scriptures, that is exactly what they would be doing. In fact, if you go to Zechariah, I promise you've never heard this preached in your Zionist churches before. I promise you've never heard this preached in your Hebrew Roots church before. But you know what? What should they do? Okay, if Jews are technically right, and obviously we know they're not, but do we have some precedent to know what they should do since they don't have a temple? Because understand, all of their feasts and things that they kept, they all involve the things of the temple. And Jews today, they will often even say, well, we can't do those things because we don't have a temple. Okay, fine. Then what should you do? Why don't we go to the Bible? Why don't we go to the Old Testament to find out what you should do? Okay, let's just assume they're right for 5 seconds. Let's just assume the Messiah never came. The old covenant is still in place. What should they do since they don't have a temple? Well, in Zechariah 7:1, this was written after they came out of the Babylonian captivity. This came when they were while they were in the midst of building the second temple. And it says, and it came to pass in the fourth year of King Darius that the word of the Lord came unto Zechariah in the fourth day in the ninth month, even in Chislew. And when they had sent into the house of God, Sharezer and Regmelech and their men to pray before the Lord and to speak unto the priests, which were in the house of the Lord of hosts, and to the prophets, saying, should I weep in the fifth month, separating myself as I have done these so many years? Then came the word of the Lord of hosts unto me, saying, speak unto all the people of the land and to the priests, saying, when ye fasted and mourned in the fifth and seventh month, even those 70 years, did ye at all fast unto me, even to me? Okay, now I'm not going to read all of chapter 7, but here's what we're seeing right here in chapter 7. The temple is being built again. They're excited. They have had a practice for the last 70 years on the fifth and seventh month of mourning, weeping, and fasting. What were they mourning, weeping, and fasting over? The loss of their temple. Obviously, if they lose the temple, they lose the presence of God amongst them as a people. And so, of course, they should be mourning and fasting if they don't have a temple. That was an appropriate response. But now that the temple is being rebuilt, it's like, hey, do we need to do this anymore? This is a good thing. This is a great day. And basically, if you read the rest of chapter 7, if I may paraphrase it a little bit, the prophet basically tells them, if you've learned your lesson, then yes, you can quit. Yes, you don't need to do that practice anymore, assuming you learned your lesson. Okay, so they stopped that practice of mourning and fasting. Well, if they don't have a temple again, shouldn't they be doing the same thing that they did before? Okay, now that's really here's the problem with that. That you're gonna have a tough time competing with Christmas. And that's what Hanukkah is. It's competition with Christmas. And if all the Gentiles and all the Christians are out there eating Christmas hams, stuffing their faces, having a good time, rejoicing, singing songs about joy to the world, having good time, it's the most wonderful time of the year and all that. And then you all are spending all of your time mourning and fasting and weeping. You think your kids are going to want to continue in that? Of course not. But that's what they should be doing, assuming you're right. Here's a problem. You're wrong. Okay. Yeah. You just need to understand Jesus Christ. God recognized the fact that you all could not keep the law. Hey, listen, and I'm talking to the Jewish people right now. You couldn't keep the law, but God loved you. God remembered his promise that he made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God preserved you through those centuries, and God kept his promise to you. And he raised up a righteous seed. He raised up a prophet among your own brethren, like unto Moses. And Jesus Christ, he went, and yes, at the triumphal entry, when he went into that temple, it was not acceptable. But at the same time, he did not forget his covenant he made with Abraham. And he offered up himself as a perfect sacrifice. He finished the work. He made a way of salvation for you. Today you can be saved if you will believe on him. And you can rejoice with the rest of us. You can rejoice during this time. You can rejoice year round. You don't need to go to the weeping, wailing wall anymore. Because you know why? Because there's no need to cry anymore. That is the one practice that they do that is actually consistent with Old Testament practices, the weeping at the wailing wall. I've seen them there doing that. I've seen them there weeping. That is appropriate, assuming that they are right in their theology. They're wrong, but if they were right, that is an appropriate practice. What is weird and what is foreign is them celebrating a lighting of a menorah, them celebrating a victory that has been completely undone. Yeah, you got the victory. You got rid of the Greeks. You built up the walls, but the Romans knocked them down. And the temple got wiped out again. And you still don't have a temple. Why are you celebrating? You have nothing to celebrate. You are like a woman celebrating her anniversary after her husband divorced her. It doesn't make any sense to do that kind of thing. So, but ignorant Christians, they do so desperate to just throw the Jews a bone. What do? They just go, John 10:22. Well, and let's go ahead and read John 10:22. It says, and it was at Jerusalem at the feast of the dedication, and it was winter. Okay, and so right there, people, they see that and they're like, oh man, in wintertime too, that's close to Christmas. I mean, yeah, this is completely legit. Jesus is at the temple and the Feast of Dedication. And again, you would not know what the Feast of Dedication was if it were not for Maccabees. The Bible does not refer to it anywhere else. This is the only reference in all the Bible to the Feast of Dedication. And it was an 8-day thing. Now, let me just say this, okay? Was Jesus there lighting a menorah? I mean, you know, was Jesus there doing whatever practice people do? Of course not. Okay, we don't really know what he was doing. But one thing that we see, even after the time of Christ, the apostles often would go to Jerusalem during their big feast days. You know why? Because that was the best time to preach to Jews. Often these Hebrew roots people are like, look, Paul, he's going to Jerusalem on the Passover. Well, you know, why is he doing that? Because Christians should still be keeping all those feasts. No. If you want to preach to Jews, wouldn't you want to go where Jews are going, or where on a time when the most Jews are going to be there? That's the best time to go. And Jesus, in wanting to preach to the Jews, it would be appropriate for him to go during a time when there's going to be a lot of Jews around there. So it says he was at the Jerusalem at the Feast of Dedication, and it was winter, and Jesus walked in the temple in Solomon's porch. And then came the Jews round about him and said unto him, how long dost thou make us to doubt? If thou be the Christ, tell us plainly. Jesus answered them, I told you, and ye believe not. The works that I do in my Father's name, they bear witness of me. But ye believe not, because ye are not of my sheep, as I said unto you. Whoa, Jesus just told them he's not of his sheep. Thought they were his chosen people. My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. And I give unto them eternal life, and they shall never perish, neither shall any man pluck them out of my hand. My Father which gave them me is greater than all, and no man is able to pluck them out of my Father's hand. I and my Father are one. Then the Jews took up stones again to stone him. Did you all see? Why don't they ever talk about what happened at the Feast of Dedication? Y'all remember? So they do. They try to use a reference to the Feast of Dedication and Jesus being at Jerusalem as a way to connect us with the Jews who reject Jesus Christ today. What happened at the Feast of Dedication? The Jews wanted to stone Jesus. And it's just, how does that justify Hanukkah? They don't even know what the Feast of Dedication is. It was the celebrating of them taking back the temple, that fellowship being restored. And as Christians, we understand we don't need those things today anymore. So it makes absolutely no sense at all, but they will do anything to just throw them a bone, try to find some kind of connection, and it doesn't make sense. In fact, we see in Matthew chapter 24, after Christ's triumphal entry, after him declaring the temple desolate, it says Jesus went out and departed from the temple and his disciples and came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, see ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another, which shall not be thrown down. Okay, that's why they built those walls, to avoid that very thing happening. And so understand, when the temple was destroyed the first time, they had a time of weeping and fasting. Why aren't they doing that again? Why are they celebrating as if they have the victory right now? No, they're in defeat right now, if they're right. Okay, now the reality is, if they would believe on Christ, they would recognize everything that the temple was meant to do for them. Jesus Christ has already done it through the cross, not through the temple made with hands, through the temple of his body. They tore down that temple, and in 3 days, he raised it up again. That is the temple that matters. That is the one we care about. The fact Jesus Christ is the light of the world, not a golden candle sitting in a building that's probably hidden at the Vatican somewhere. They probably still have it in Rome, if it's still in existence at all. Okay, if y'all, that's just my opinion on that. I mean, folks, come on. They basically carved it on their arch, them taking it. And they, of course, they brought it back with them. I guess they could have stashed it somewhere in Jerusalem, but I don't think they're going to leave a big candlestick of gold like that behind. I really don't, but you know, either way, that's another subject for another day. I guess it could have melted down in the temple when it was destroyed. So it either doesn't exist or it's hidden somewhere in Rome. The Vatican's probably got it. That's just my opinion on that. That really doesn't matter. But there, I say all this to say that there is no biblical precedent for Jews to celebrate the Feast of Dedication. Okay, if they want to have a time of remembrance of it or something like that, but it should be a time of mourning and sorrow for them for the fact that the lamp is out today. For Christians, it is beyond ridiculous because we understand Jesus is that light of the world. And so for us to, you know, just to try to throw them a bone like that, if anything, we're leading more Jews to hell. And boy, I hope nobody ever does anything so rotten to me as to love me the way many Christians love the Jews. You guys are loving them right into hell with your stupidity and wickedness and just ignorance of doctrine. And so I have not been paying any attention to the live chat, so I'm going to go ahead and go on here and start reading some questions. But I think I addressed most of the points that I wanted to make. And so basically, celebrating the rededication of a temple that is gone doesn't make sense. Also, it is inconsistent with the practices they had before. Before, when the temple was destroyed, they had a time of weeping and fasting. For Christians, it's beyond ridiculous because God never saved anybody from anything in the temple. It was all done through the body and blood of Jesus Christ. It was all done through the new covenant. And I don't have time to spend on this, but this is why it is very wrong. And we have got to continue calling out this heresy, this dispensational heresy that says the new covenant is different from the New Testament and it is just for the Jews and it is still to come. No, the new covenant was the body and blood of Jesus Christ. It has come and it is for the world, Jew and Gentile. So we've got some questions here. We have a question from Kobe. It says, which KJV is perfect? It is a translation that has gone through many changes over the years. It is a Catholic Bible. It had Apocrypha for 275 years. That sounds more like it is a statement rather than a question. So I don't really understand the point of that. I think my King James Bible that I have right here, a 1769 edition, I think it's perfect. I think the 1611 was perfect too. It's just harder to read because of the spellings, the font, all those different things. The Apocrypha in there was just put in there just like the maps were put in there and the genealogies that they put in there. There were a lot of, my Bible has maps. My Bible has a concordance in it. Those things aren't, just because it's contained inside these pages doesn't mean it's all inspired. The scripture is what is inspired, and the Apocrypha has never been recognized as scripture, even by the Jews. They didn't recognize it as scripture. It's historical, but it's not scripture. There's also, in the beginning of my Bible, I've got my family tree. That's not expired, that's not inspired. Many King James Bibles, this one here does not have it. It has a preface to the readers that were written, or from the translators to the readers. That also is not inspired, but it's in my King James Bible. So yeah, this 1769 King James Bible I have, it's perfect. And so I like the, it's a Catholic thing, as you know, Catholics, they've got their Douay Rheims Bible. So yeah, that's not the topic for today. But if anybody has any, relevant questions, that'd be better. Somebody left a comment on here too. In the show, The Chosen, they had Jesus celebrating Hanukkah. That does not surprise me at all. I have not seen a single episode of The Chosen. I've been half tempted to watch it just because it is influencing a lot of people. And just so I know, I can be aware of where people are being deceived and what is deceiving them. And unfortunately, works of fiction like that, that are based on reality, often do form people's thinking. You know, for example, too, on this program, we have showed how our modern rapture theology has been very influenced by books from the last century and movies. Most people today, most independent fundamental King James only Baptist, believe we disappear in the rapture and our clothes are going to fall to the ground. And they preach that from the pulpits. I used to preach that from the pulpits. Then finally one day I decided I was going to show people in the Bible where we get that. Because of course we get all our theology. We get all our ideas straight out of our King James Bible. And so I was going to preach a short sermon. I was going to show people that. And I was like, well, that's not exactly what it says. And since then, I've even found other places that makes that inconsistent. We are not going to disappear in the rapture. That is not what the Bible teaches. But yet, it was portrayed that way in a movie. And now it is theology in people's minds. And maybe one of the reasons we're seeing so many people now, it was only 2 or 3 years ago, I first heard somebody bring up John 10:22 and Jesus celebrating Hanukkah. And I'm like, how is that Jesus celebrating Hanukkah? He just says he's at Jerusalem at the Feast of Dedication and the Jews want to stone him there. And so I went and I looked up the Feast of Dedication. I found out, okay, yeah, that is connected with Hanukkah. Where does that come from? Well, it comes from the Apocrypha. I read what the Apocrypha said about it. There's nothing in there about the miracle of the lamp being lit. Looked up where that's from. According to Jewish sources, that actually comes from the Babylonian Talmud. You know, and so this is becoming a bigger thing. And I would guarantee you that the Chosen has been a big part of that. And it's very important to let people know the origins of their doctrine. It's kind of like the Abraham's bosom doctrine. Okay. Now, theologians are never going to admit that they got their theology from the Chosen. They would never admit that in 1,000 years. But what happens, somebody on the watches the Chosen, they get that idea. And then what ends up happening, they end up preaching it. Somebody else hears it. And then they think they got it from the Bible. Well, the Abraham's bosom doctrine, that is another one. I love tracing origins. And so people, they'll always tell you, well, I got this from the Bible. Okay, well then if you got it from the Bible, you should be able to show me this in the Bible. And I'll go read the Bible and it's like, that is not what it says. What put this image in your mind? Because the words of God are not painting that same image. This image people have in their minds of the two compartments in hell, where Jesus is going and leading captivity captive, meaning he's taking the saints out of paradise. You know, when you go read all the passages talking about leading captivity captive, it's like, wait a minute, that's not what it's describing. Where did people get that image in their head? Most of you heard other preachers refer to it. I have traced the origins of that, and it comes from a 4th century Gospel of Nicodemus is where that comes from. That is the origin of that. It is fan fiction is what it is. And it's made its way into doctrine. You cannot display the doctrine of Abraham's bosom from the Bible. An image has been put in your mind by fan fiction. And that's and I guarantee you that's what's happening right now. I am not surprised the Chosen has done this. That probably is why I'm seeing so many Christians talk about that right now. They fell for that propaganda. And now people like myself who actually preach what the Bible says, we're going to get accused of being against the Bible because we're going to be telling a very different story than what's in people's brain that got imprinted there from the Chosen, from a movie. And that irritates me greatly. This Abraham's bosom doctrine too is about to get even more cemented in people's minds with Mel Gibson's The Passion 2 that's coming out, where he is going to show the Catholic version of the harrowing of hell, which the basis of that is the Gospel of Nicodemus. I'm hoping that through this new Passion of the Christ 2, where they have this harrowing of hell teaching, I'm hoping it's going to draw an attention to the origin of that story, which is the Gospel of Nicodemus, section 2, the descent into hell. And then people are going to be like, wait a minute, this is super Catholic. Why in the world are we teaching this stuff in our pulpits? I'm hoping maybe it will have an opposite effect, but I am a little concerned. But yeah, so let me try to go through here. If you have any questions, again, if you can, there's a lot of comments on here. If you can start out with question, it'll help me see it. I'm trying to read through all of this. There was a Hanukkah miracle. That's why my people celebrate Hanukkah. Do y'all know what the miracle is? I ask this with peace and love. Yes. Okay, let me ask you, Montana Mike, what is the origin of that story? Who told it first? Okay. And even the Jews will tell you it came from the Talmud. Okay. Now, maybe you trust the Talmud. I've got many reasons not to trust the Talmud. It is very blasphemous. It is very antichrist. There's a lot of weird, crazy stuff in there. That is not a good source. Why is it not mentioned in Maccabees? I mean, the candlestick is even talked about. It goes into a lot of detail about them preparing for the rededication. And then people will say, well, it's in 2 Maccabees too. 2 Maccabees refers to the Feast of Dedication and the cleansing of the temple. It doesn't tell that story either. People are just trying to act like, well, we got one more source. No, you got one more source that there was a Feast of Dedication. Okay. I have no problem with that, especially when the New Testament refers to it. But all these practices that you've inserted with it, okay, that is what is not right. And so Jews go to the Western Wall to pray, not to wail, giving y'all the side eye with kindness and wishing some reservation. There's a greater cultural understanding. Why don't you tell that to people I've watched wail at the Wailing Wall? Okay. Yeah, not all of them do that. I've got a video of one guy literally making out with a wall. That was really weird. I got another video of a guy dancing at the wall. A lot of them do pray at the wall. They do their weird head bowing thing, or head banging thing or whatever. Some of them do other things that look really weird that I'd rather not describe what it looks like. But yeah, a lot of them do wail. It's been called the Wailing Wall for a long time for a reason. That is offensive to Jewish people. But it has been called that for a long time. And so, let me keep reading. Will Hanukkah lead you to lose your salvation or get your name erased from the book? Well, thankfully, your name cannot get erased from the Lamb's Book of Life. You can get blotted out of the Book of the Living, but you cannot lose your salvation. And people who practice things like Hanukkah, the danger of that is, one, it is a very bad testimony. It sends a very wrong message to Christians and Jews. And the thing is, too, another big problem with celebrating something like Hanukkah, and I'm not trying to be offensive right now, I'm just stating facts, but it's so dumb, okay? It's kind of like speaking in tongues. Speaking in tongues is so foolish. It's very difficult for people who have spoken in tongues to admit that what they were doing was just complete foolishness and that they got completely caught up in motions and acted like a weirdo. That's hard for people to overcome. And it does take a high level of ignorance for somebody for a Christian especially, to practice something like Hanukkah. And most people do not have the humility to admit, I was very clueless when I did that. That was really wrong. And so they try to justify it. And literally all these people, they're using John 10:22. I had a guy just unfriend me on Facebook because this is a Baptist and he's posting pictures of them light and menorah. And I'm like, what in the world are you celebrating? You know, he doesn't know. He has no idea why he's doing these things. But he has gotten caught up in these Hebrew roots thing. And I called him out on it. And you know what? He called me anti-Semitic. What in the world? I am literally the least anti-Semitic person probably on the planet, in my opinion. And I have no hatred for Jewish people at all. But I do. In fact, if I hated Jewish people, I'd encourage them to keep on doing it because it's one more thing leading them away from Christ and leading them to hell. They need to forget the temple. I just paraphrased. I said in there that, you know, we need to follow Christ without the camp, bearing his reproach. And yeah, you're going to get reproached by the Jews if you reject those things. And he called me anti-Semitic. That's straight out of Hebrews. I said, there's a reason the wrath has come on them to the uttermost. Call me anti-Semitic. That's quoting Paul. You quote Paul, you quote Hebrews, you get called anti-Semitic in 2024 libtarded America. It's absolutely ridiculous. So this kind of thing is ridiculous. And so apparently I accidentally skipped over a bunch of some other things too. So here's a question. When Jesus said in Matthew, there will never be a time like it, referring to the most horrific time yet to come, was he referring to the time just before the destruction of Jerusalem and then it stops? I think when Jesus is speaking there in Matthew 24, I absolutely believe there's kind of a dual purpose to what he's saying, because he is directly referencing the temple and the coming destruction that that he is prophesying that came in that generation. And for sure, that was the worst time that ever had come on Jerusalem. There's absolutely no doubt about it on there. So there was kind of a shadow fulfillment that took place then. But I also believe too that we are seeing a pattern of what God is going to do on the entire world that is very consistent with what we see outlined in Revelation, that is not about the destruction of Jerusalem, but it is about judgment on the world and about tribulation that is going to come on the world. So I don't have a problem with application being made in both places. That is consistent with Bible prophecy. Where the full preterists and the full futurists are wrong. The full preterists deny the future application. The full futurists are wrong because they deny the past application. And that neither of them realize how inconsistent they have to be with their Bible interpretation to do that. For example, okay, many of David's Psalms where he is writing about himself, everyone will tell you that these are messianic Psalms, where David often would write about things that were personal, that were about himself, but he was also writing prophetically. For example, David one time said all his bones were out of joint. They pierced my hands and feet. They parted my garment among them, and on my vesture they cast lots. And if you go and you read all of those Psalms, one of the things that they will all have in common is David is writing poetically. He's writing metaphorically about himself and things that he's going through. I poured out my spirit like water. It says all my bones are out of joint. But then we see hundreds of years later, a very literal fulfillment of that with Jesus Christ. And there are many Psalms like that. I am interpreting Matthew 24 the same way we interpret Messianic Psalms. That's the difference between me and the full preterist and the full futurist. Both are equally foolish. Full preterism has greater heresies because they deny a future resurrection. But full futurism has just equal goofiness in their interpreting of the scriptures. It's very frustrating. And so we are consistent. I interpret New Testament prophecy the same way Old Testament prophecy was fulfilled. And that's the advantage that we have. We have so many prophecies from the Old Testament that were fulfilled. It's very easy for us now to kind of go back and use those as a template for how we should interpret prophecy today. And so, you know, futurists and preterists fighting with each other, they both keep having the pendulum effect. They both keep swinging the pendulum too far in one direction, and they just both keep going into foolishness. And so, yeah, I think you can make application to both. Just like two, when you see David saying, "Thou wilt not leave my soul in hell, nor suffer thine Holy One to see corruption," I do believe David was writing about himself in a figurative way. Okay? He's speaking of himself figuratively. I just watched a video today by Mark Ward talking about hell as a false friend. And that was, you know, that was a very disappointing video. And I probably should do a video breaking down all of his errors in that video, because basically what Mark Ward did is he imposed his theology into the interpretation of that text. And the problem is his theology is wrong, and so he messed the text up. And what he was trying to do with "thou wilt not leave my soul in hell," because it's like, well, you know, David, you know, obviously David didn't go to literal hell. And then people ask, well, and obviously Jesus couldn't have either. This must be figurative. This must be talking about the grave, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and not actually referring to hell, not understanding that David often did that in his Psalms. He wrote about himself in a very figurative way, but then Jesus literally fulfilled those things. So yeah, I don't believe David went to hell. Okay. But I do believe, but David did go to a grave that is that can be seen as kind of a figure and metaphoric of that type of thing. Also, I don't believe there was ever a time where all of David's bones were out of joint. And I don't know, maybe there was a time they cast lots upon his vesture. I kind of doubt it. I don't think his hands and feet were ever pierced. I think he was speaking metaphorically. So if somebody were to come along and to say, well, in these Psalms, when David's writing here, he's speaking about himself, but he's speaking metaphorically. For example, if a Jewish rabbi said that, he's probably right. Here's where he would be wrong, is if he said that did not apply to Jesus. That would be dead wrong. And Mark Ward would not do that with all my bones are out of joint. They pierce my hands and feet. He wouldn't do that with all those things. You know, my soul's poured out like water. I think that's how that goes. I'm probably not quoting that exactly right. I mean, Jesus literally had blood and water flowing out of him. Everything that the psalmist spoke of, where he is speaking of himself in a very figurative way, Jesus literally fulfilled that. That is how you interpret prophecy. And I'm just trying to get people to show some consistency when it comes to this. So I'm about to shut it down. So if anybody has any more questions, please try to get them in there quick. If I missed you, just you're going to have to put it in there again, because I'm not going to be able to go through and read all these again. But I'm trying to. People get married at the wall, name their children at the wall, pray and weep to God, and lots of things that you maybe don't understand because it's a historical site and it's significant. I am very aware of all that stuff. I have spent a lot of time at the Wailing Wall. I have observed much of the behavior there at the Wailing Wall. In fact, I'm also very familiar with the fact that that wall absolutely is not connected with Solomon's Temple. That was probably built by Herod. It's from a Roman fortress. And if you go down into the Western Wall tunnels, you can even see carvings on there. And it's something that's in Latin. I don't know how to pronounce it, but basically showing the Roman legion that was housed there. It literally has it identified down there into that wall. Go watch Temple, A City Lost when it comes out. It's going to be coming out this next year, and I am really excited about it. The Jews have been praying to a Roman fortress, ancient Roman fortress wall, for centuries. For centuries, they've done this. And it just shows the blindness. It shows it's symbolic of the outer darkness that they're in. And that's what Jesus said. They're going to be cast into outer darkness, where there's going to be wailing and gnashing of teeth. And what do they do? They've been cast out. They are outside the things of the temple. They can't get in. They're wailing at that wall. So I always thought that was about hell. It is. It is. That will be the ultimate fulfillment of that. But figuratively speaking, that has been the case for the last 2,000 years. And I don't think it's a coincidence that they're doing that. And so, Liberty Baptist Church, Jews are welcome. We do. We love the Jews. We give gospel to the Jews. We tell them the truth. We are, we love them too much to be afraid of them and to lie to them. And I love all these Christians who brag about how much Jewish people love them and like them. And it's like, wow, Jesus, boy, he must have been really bad to those Jews for the way they treat him. Oh, the Apostle Paul, they didn't like him very much either. The John the Baptist. It's like the Jews hated all of the greatest Christians in the Bible and Jesus himself. And then you've got Christians today. Man, you ought to see how much the Jews love me. I really am good to them. I've got a bunch of blessings coming my way. You people do not know the Bible. And I don't think we ought to try to make them dislike us. Good night. I don't try to make Jews dislike me. I'm very kind to them. When I was over in Israel, I spoke with many of them while I was there. And we had some fun conversations, interesting conversations, and most of them were nice to me, and I was nice to all of them. One of them, now I noticed, I don't know if it's just kind of a cultural thing, but when you have conversations with them, they do most of the talking. It's hard to get a word in edgewise. And my wife tells me that I have a tendency to sometimes dominate conversations, and I got to watch out for that. But man, those people over there, they put me to shame. They absolutely dominate me in conversations. But I even had one of them, and I thank God this isn't on video. But I was there with Brother Paul, and we were talking to one. And he started describing something to us, and he went and he like grabbed our hands and started like pulling us and dancing in a circle while he sang something Jewish. And oh man, if that ever were to surface on video, I would be humiliated for life. But it was really weird and really awkward, and he just kind of forced it. These people are they're very forceful in their behavior. But anyway, we got another question here. This is going to be the last question, and I'm going to shut this down. But it says, Joel describing God's anger towards those who parted my land. The Zionists say this is referring to a two-state solution, but this did this refer to the past? Oh my, sorry. So they apply that to the two-state solution. I'm not sure which verse exactly, but Joel 2, if you let's go ahead and go back to Joel chapter 2, because I want to make sure I'm right in this. But this would have been during a time, though, when you had the kingdom that was split. And so let me see. It says, therefore also now saith the Lord, turn ye even to me with all your heart, and with fasting, and with weeping, and with mourning, and rend your heart and not your garments, and turn unto the Lord your God, for he is a gracious and merciful, slow to anger and of great kindness, and repenteth him of the evil. Who knoweth if he will return and repent and leave a blessing behind him, even a meat offering and a drink offering unto the Lord your God. Blow a trumpet in Zion, sanctify a fast, call a solemn assembly, gather the people. I'm not seeing. Hang on. Let me keep reading. Yeah. I'll remove from far off the northern army, drive them to land barren. Yeah. See, this is all stuff referring to when the kingdom was split and the Assyrians were on their way. And then later you had the Babylonians that were going to come through, that were going to basically. So yeah, this stuff, that's all stuff from the past that's not about the future. Obviously there's some things in there that refer to the day of the Lord. There have been multiple days of the Lord. Okay. Now there is the day of the Lord that we're all waiting for. And I think I've done other podcasts on this in the past showing how, again, in prophecy, there is a day of the Lord that is going to come that we're all waiting for. But throughout time, there have been what we would refer to as localized days of the Lord, where if you read the prophecy, God is pronouncing judgment on a city, God's pronouncing judgment on a specific nation, and it will reference the day of the Lord. And the reason it's doing this is because, again, it's God uses these other judgments as reminders of a judgment that's coming in the future on all the world. And so, for example, Sodom and Gomorrah is a great example. When God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, that destruction was an example to all those in the future that after should live ungodly. So God would do these judgments, these localized judgments, as a reminder that he is going to judge the world one day in the future. And so when we're reading things like Joel 2 and many of these Old Testament prophecies, they are describing specifically local judgments, but they also have references to the day of the Lord that is to come in the future. And so you have to be careful to not make, again, don't be like a full futurist and then make everything about the future, but don't be like a full preterist and make everything about the past. Understand, no, this had a relevance for them in that day, and there can be an application in the future just in the sense of, you know, judgment is coming on the world. But a lot of that specific stuff, it was more of a localized thing. So hopefully that helps. I am not completely prepared to break down everything we have there in Joel chapter 2, but hopefully that helps a little bit. But anyway, I do appreciate everybody watching this. I appreciate all the support. In the last year, we had a great year in the Spirit of Prophecy podcast. We had a great year at Liberty Baptist Church, especially, and it's really got me excited for 2025. I am anticipating a great year. We have plans for great things. Obviously, we are dependent ultimately on the Lord. Obviously, the devil is going to fight and do whatever he can to derail things. And no matter what, we are still going to be dependent on God, and that's fine. But I'm planning, expecting great things. I think this year is going to be a great year for the podcast as well. We are really kind of getting this podcast out there. More and more people are interested in it. It's getting easier and easier for me to get guests on the podcast, I don't get refused too often anymore, because we have a reputation of being controversial, but also being fair on here. And so it's making it where even people who disagree with me are willing to come on this program. It is just enjoyable. It is edifying to watch. And so, you know, I think, and I have no intention, I'm not doing like a long con so I can get some big name on here and then just absolutely, you know, be unfair and have a dumpster fire. No, we're going to continue doing that same thing. And so I think this is only going to grow. I also have a trip to Israel on the schedule. It is not 100% locked in yet, but I am planning, just myself and my son, we are going to go over there and we are going to record a bunch of different content that I'm wanting to use for this program. I am really excited about this trip. But what we're also going to be doing too, that I plan on sharing on this channel, is I'm going to do like a vlog of the trip, basically promoting another trip that I'm going to do just like it. And so I've got a plan to take a bunch of pastors and whoever wants to go over to Israel, where you are going to get the ultimate tour of Jerusalem. It will not be a Zionist infomercial. I mean, it is going to be an amazing trip, but I've got to make sure a few things are going to work out right. There's a few things I got to experiment on. I got to test out. One of the things I'm kind of hoping to do in the trip is I'm wanting to go to Bethlehem. That's not very far from there, but it's in Palestinian territory. We would have to take a bus. I don't want to try doing these things that I'm not familiar with how it's all going to work with a big group of people. I would rather do it by myself first, just to make sure I know what I'm in for. But this trip is going to be so stinking awesome. I've got a hotel picked out that is right by the old city. You will be able to just walk right out of your hotel room, and in one block, you're in the old city, and you will feel like you're back in time. You'll feel like you're in another world, in another era, and the things that we will see, the experiences we will have. The one thing I am looking forward to the most when I take a group of preachers over there is we are going to go to the Mount of Olives and talk prophecy, where Jesus gave the main prophecy we all like to talk about, the Olivet Discourse. And we are going to be looking at many of the things that Jesus and his disciples have been looking at. Obviously, the temple's gone. A lot of those things are gone, but there are some things down there too that I can show you that they would have been able to see in Jesus's day. And folks, who doesn't like sitting around talking about prophecy with a bunch of preachers? And who wouldn't like doing that in Jerusalem, in the place where Jesus sat around with his disciples talking prophecy? I am so stoked about this. It's not even funny. And so hopefully we'll be doing that in the next few months. And so we are, we're going to get all kinds of good stuff and show it to you. And so again, if you want to be a member, if you're not a member, that's fine. Just subscribe. All right. It is so free. It is so easy to just click subscribe, hit the thumbs up on there. Okay. I mean, like right now we've got almost 40 people watching, and how many thumbs up do we even have? Okay. Y'all got to help me out here. We got 20 thumbs up, half of you. Okay. And I'll bet the half of you that haven't given the thumbs up are the half that aren't subscribed. Y'all from California and Texas, afraid your pastor is going to find out you've been watching the Spirit of Prophecy podcast. Just hit the like button, hit the subscribe button, and help me get these out there. The more we get this out here, the more it spreads, the more power we will have to influence for the better, to rid the Baptist world of Zionist theology. We need to undo what the Chosen is doing to Baptist people. We've got to stop this, and we are going to do that on the Spirit of Prophecy podcast. But either way, anything you do to support the channel, I appreciate so much. There's people who donate to the church. That is a huge blessing. Some have donated specifically to the podcast. If you'd like to help with the Israel trip, all that, man, that kind of stuff, it really does mean a lot. It motivates me. It motivates our church, and we want to continue doing great things. And so anyway, I think that's all we have for today, but I do appreciate everyone watching this. And yeah, please help me like it and share it. It makes a big difference, doing that kind of thing. And, in the new year, I've got a few other plans for some things I'm wanting to do in this program. I'm also working on another way that you can kind of be even more of a help. Not doesn't cost you any money at all, but just kind of ways to help kind of, you can help me spread the content of this program. But I'm still working on some of the technical details on that. And so hopefully we'll get that all figured out soon. I'm very slow with technology, learning new things. Some of the stuff that has been unlocked now that we have memberships and stuff on YouTube, I'm still trying to figure all that out. So if there's any experts out there that know how these things work, if you could help me with that, that would be a great blessing. But either way, I do want to wish everyone a happy new year. I hope 2025 will be your greatest year. And thank the Lord for all that he has done in 2024. It's been a good year. So thank you all for watching. God bless. We'll see y'all next time.